historical mark. John is one of those gospels together with Matthew that wants to prove the Jewishness of Jesus and do it in spades, you know. And yet we have throughout the gospel translations of Hebrew terms. I mean, if he's writing to a bunch of Jews, they didn't even hear what rabbi meant or messiah meant, so it's one of those natural scholarly mysteries. So I thought you can think about that on the way home and over supper. This business of Paul was not anti-sex, although he's frequently depicted as that. Sex, of course, is the great third rail in Catholic theology. So I'd like to make a recommendation first and a couple more next week, because there have been some really serious writing about sexuality, and one of the most helpful I found is by a great scholar of the period of the first six centuries, Peter Brown. You know Peter Brown? He's wonderful. I just started another 550-page book on poverty in the New Testament. He doesn't write little books, but he writes clearly and succinctly, and he has one about sex and the variety of attitudes toward sexuality among the early Christian fathers. Not mothers. The mothers had to keep their mouths shut and just behave themselves. So if anybody's interested, then you can Google Peter Brown, nice name to remember, and go through his 10 or so books and find out the one on sex. And I found it very useful. Okay. Now to get down to cases. I'd like to try a little imaginative experiment. So when Jesus says to these guys who are following him, come and see. Now, just for a second, where did Jesus want them to come? Think about it, or imagine it. Imagine the possibilities. Where did Jesus want them to come? An honest question. Not self-evident. It takes the effort of the imagination to work on them. Where did Jesus want them to come? Okay, I will bet my house, my dogs, my CD collection, my library, that Jesus was not pointing to the 12 rooms of the papal apartments in the Vatican when he said, well, come and see. It's highly implausible. Of course, they didn't exist at that time, but the equivalent existed. And can you imagine Jesus saying, come to my dig? You know, I'm at the... the Marriott is not high class enough. I don't go to a hotel, so... What's the highest class hotel?
The Ritz.
The Ritz. There you go. Thank you, Pia. Mm-hmm. All right. Jesus digs at the Ritz? Think about it. There's a grave implausibility here. Yeah. This is all agitated in my mind for the past couple of weeks because I had the enormous pleasure of three long conversations with three young men, three different young men, very different backgrounds. Very sensitive to issues of justice and peace and poverty. I know them well. We've talked about this stuff regularly. And every time we get together, we talk about that stuff. Two of these guys were raised Catholic. They left the church. The third guy had grandparents in Holland, and his grandfather left the church because of the pedophile business. It is no surprise that one out of every three Catholics in the States have left the church. And the only reason it hasn't collapsed completely is because you've got all of these immigrants coming up from the Philippines and Latin America. But that really struck me. Why should these really, really exceptionally good, exceptionally bright, exceptionally sensitive people find that the church was simply inhospitable to them? they're not cockeyed maniacs. You know, they didn't go out and picket and, you know, write nasty letters to the Free Press or the Pope or the Bishop or anybody else. They're eminently sensible, eminently good guys to give me hope. They sustain me by their goodness. But they can't find a home in the church. I think that is really profoundly serious issue. They didn't walk off in a snit. They're not angry now even. Gravely disappointed, I think. But I felt terrible after each one of those conversations. Why did these guys, of all people, leave the church? Find the church not a fit place to live one's life. The deepest things in one's life. I think that's worth a lot of thought, too. And certainly I've been giving it a lot of thought. And it comes down to, I think, a position that is fairly unpalatable to most of us, to me, surely. It can be summed up in the title of a wonderful book by William Stringfellow, that saintly Anglican lawyer who got out of Harvard Law School and set up a shop in Harlem where he charged $1 a consultation for everybody who came to him off the street. He's a homosexual too, by the way. He sheltered Daniel Berrigan. You may know the Jesuit peace activist. The cops, the FBI found him in his house on Fire Island where he was with his partner. Not Daniel Berrigan's partner. He didn't have one so far as I know, but this William Stringfellow's partner. And the title of one of his books, and all of his books are eminently worth reading, and mercifully, they're all quite short. A Stranger in a Strange Land. If there's a besetting sin of the church in the States and here in Canada too, I suspect, it is the domestication of the church. We've tamed the church. We made the church inoffensive. We made the church agreeable to conventions, social conventions. We're not supposed to fit here. And yet we exert enormous energy in accommodating a society that is, can hardly be called Christian except in the most cosmetic terms. The simplest, the most superficial terms. Again, I keep going back to that wonderful quotation that Dorothy Day, another great Christian figure, loved so much, Fyodor Dostoevsky. She quoted it all the time. Love is a harsh and dreadful thing. Put that in an ad for lingerie or new cars. It won't fit. I don't think any of the gospel will fit in ads, as a matter of fact. They're all basically appeals to one's self-aggrandizement in terms of power, wealth, body shape, blah, 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 blah. Just sit and watch. Because, what, ads take up 15 minutes out of every hour on the TV? See what they're attracting. See what they really want people to give in to. You know? It is all self-absorbed, it seems to me. And that's exactly what they try to do. And so, listening to those three young men made me think about all this stuff. Just finished a book, a wonderful autobiography by another scholar named Lamine Sané, who taught at Harvard, and he's presently at Yale, I think, because he found Harvard too intolerant. He was born a Muslim in the Gambia in Africa, and then went to a bunch of Christian churches, and strangely enough, ended up Catholic. The great Avery Dulles was in Africa and baptized him. But he makes the point about the domestication of the Christian message. You know, we sold out to the politicians, to the advertisers, to the merchants. I really, deep in my heart, I believe this is what is supposed to be going on, that resistance. I don't find it in my own life, at least not very loud. But by God, if it's not that, what is it? What are we? That's an enormously important question. What are we? Are we residents of the Ritz? Or followers of the Gospel of Luke, Jesus, who said, foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, and the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head? Probably an exaggeration. I mean, he had to go someplace. But this speaks the kind of digs that he would seek, you know. Because you see it all over the bloody place, this terrible discrepancy between what the gospel says about human life and what often enough the church preaches. And then we have that god-awful profanation of the so-called gospel of God wants you to be a millionaire. Now, listen to any of the televangelists. Prosperity gospel. That's what we're into, prosperity. This wonderful line from Jim Baker in his salad days. He brought on a Christian stockbroker. He says, I'm here to save you by the grace of God from the ravages of inflation. Even at that time, which I heard a long time ago, it did not sit well with me. So, love is a harsh and dreadful thing. Learning to love is a harsh and dreadful process, too, as all of us who are parents know. But we need to see that as central, that is the axis upon which we're to build a Christian life.